All right, this session is building a classical Christian high school that adolescents can love. I'll introduce myself. My name is Chuck Evans. I'm an executive consultant with Paideia Incorporated. We're a firm that provides comprehensive consulting services, primarily, the after lunch thing. It's going to be lovely on the recording. For those of you who are listening to this at home, that was my lunch. Or a piece of it. All right. We provide comprehensive consulting services primarily to Christian schools and colleges. And it's my privilege, after almost 20 years in Christian education, to take what I've learned from people who have advised me over the years, many of them associated with Paideia, learn what I've learned from the faculties with whom I've worked, some of whom are sitting in this room, and the application of all of those to my own responsibilities is in leading schools. I have a burden for classical and Christian schools in the quality of their secondary programs, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I do believe in sort of that culminating effect of the high school experience, where we take students into an environment where they can use what they've learned with us, both in terms of knowledge and skills, and begin to synthesize things together, think like sophisticated adults, and begin to set the patterns, the intellectual and the spiritual patterns, for their adult lives. I believe that that's important. Secondly, I believe that we have the opportunity to provide a high school experience for students which is genuinely countercultural. And I don't mean necessarily in the way that students behave as much as I do in the way that the quality of relationships that they have with one another, the quality of relationships that they have with their teachers, the collaborative environment that the liberal arts allows us to provide, actually requires us to provide for our students. And thirdly, the social reality is that people want the opportunity to send their students to a private school for 13 years. One of the key selling points for schools to parents, we find consistently, is the opportunity for their students to stay in a single environment all the way through their high school years. Now, not everybody wants that, but a lot of people do. A lot of people do. And given an option, a private school option between a school that goes K to 6 or K through 8 and a school that goes K to 12, a good majority of parents will choose the K to 12 option. A school, though, that has a high school program needs to understand a couple of things. Number one, your school, by the way, my thing is doing this. You just notice that. If it doesn't bother you, I won't let it bother me. I'll just keep resetting. Number one, it's very, very expensive to have a good high school. And it's expensive to have a good high school for the same reasons that the rest of your school is expensive. Not because you need a gym, and not because, whatever, you need trombones for the marching band or whatever. It's expensive because the people are expensive. The people are expensive. And you need more of them in the upper school. So you need to understand that as you think about high school, you're encountering a disproportionate cost structure. And my encouragement to schools consistently is, do not open a high school until you know how you're going to afford it. That's hard for some schools because they've already made commitments or their children are getting to be high school age or whatever else. But for this next reason, it is much better for you to wait and disappoint a few families than to do high school poorly and do damage to your whole school. And the reason that you do damage to your whole school is because, for whatever reason, the combination of reasons, once you have a high school, that is how your school will be known. Nobody cares about sixth grade anymore. Nobody cares about how great your first grade is and how fast kids learn to read. What they care about is your high school. That's how you're known. They know your kids, they know their activities, they know where they're going to college. That is, that the high school becomes your school's identity. So, how do we think about building a high school that is authentically classical, reflects the values that we've already established in the rest of our school, and is attractive enough to high school students, to adolescents, that they want to be there and they want to be our partners in this for the sake of the school, for the sake of the mission, and for the sake of themselves? Let's talk about the problem that we have. When I was called to my last school, the message I heard was, please come and save our high school. Now, I had experience in secondary programs before, and there aren't a lot of us in classical schools with a lot of experience with high school programs and high school students. And so there was a sense of it that I was uniquely qualified for this. But they were, the school was in crisis, and they were experiencing what I was just telling you about. Even to the point that when I did my focus groups, my initial focus groups, as I was coming in into the position, and I started asking people, different constituencies within the school, what they thought about their own school, what are strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats, there was a persistent negative vibe regarding the high school. And so the question was, well, what do you think is wrong with it? And the question was, the answer that kept coming blaring out, and these words actually were said repeatedly by different people in different groups. Well, the high school really isn't good for kids. Really? Who's it good for? Someone other than the kids. Another story that we tell in our book that Robert Littlejohn and I wrote together is actually a collaborative story that Rhonda Clark was in on. And I was reading through, we had this new classical Christian high school, and it grew really fast. We were totally surprised that anybody came, weren't we? Well, your kids came, but that was, I was reading U.S. News and World Report. They had this report on the nation's top high schools, and one of the schools profiled of four or five was a Jewish school, a girls' school in New York City. And as I read through and they discussed the profile, one of the things that kept jumping out at me was how happy the students were. They even had pictures of girls sitting on the floor in their plaid skirts in the hallway just laughing their heads off. And I swear, I was reading that, and I set it down, I went out and stood in my hallway and watched my students go by, and they weren't happy at all. They were busy. They were scared. They weren't happy. So the idea that we have to shape a school that somehow absorbs students into the culture and gives them the freedom to be themselves and enjoy themselves is a major, major issue. Another problem that we run into in classical schools is that our success, when we've been successful, very often it's been with a very small profile of students. So we have schools that are teaching some students really well, and those kids flourish and they go on and they do really wonderful things. But we have a lot of kids who just don't make it. And one of the reasons that they don't make it is because they never start out with us because they don't think they can make it. They don't think we're going to care enough about them and who they are in order to take them through. And one of the additional problems we've got is that our attrition rates are astronomical. Now, there are only a few places in the country that I know of, that I've actually seen, where you expect that upper school enrollment in a private school would be larger than lower school enrollment. Most of our schools, and this is Christian and otherwise, have, you know, sort of a trapezoidal enrollment. We expect some attrition because there are a lot of options and very attractive options for students and parents. But what's happening in a lot of classical schools is we're going like this up through about 6th or 7th grade, and then we're just folding in on ourselves. And we are, the school I mentioned a minute ago, when I went there, they had already assumed in their financial planning attrition of 50% from middle to high school. They'd conceded that. We're only going to keep 50% of the students we've got. Yeah. What did they mean? They meant a lot of things. The question was, can I clarify what they meant when they said high school wasn't good for kids? They meant a lot of things. There were academic issues and there were social issues. But overall, I think they felt like the kids just weren't valued. The kids weren't, nobody was really paying attention to the kids. What they were paying attention to was all the stuff. And it was a great place for really smart, erudite people to come and talk about what they know. But nobody was really thinking about the kids who were supposed to be learning this stuff. And it had a bunch of different faces. But we're going to get into some of the details on that. But our attrition rates are astronomical. They're out of this world. And you know this. Okay. So what's the first principle? That's the first principle. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because they don't smell as bad. Maybe it's because they're easier to control. We have a tendency to have an easier time with this with younger students than with older students. Older students are prickly. You know, they don't like to be told what to do. Younger students seem to like to be told what to do. Well, that's great for me because I like to tell people what to do. But older students, not so much. The principle that we learn from the gospel is that God loves us, and we love Him as a response to that. And I think if we start to think that way about high school students, we'll find our way more effectively through a lot of the things that we find ourselves confronting. What are some of the disadvantages? First of all, our culture is in love with youthfulness. Youthfulness. Not just youth. The now generation never really grew up. My apologies to those of you who are part of that generation. But we all know what that means. I think it's interesting to me how quickly we've gone in advertising from the things that are, just how quickly we've moved toward retirement advertising. Have you noticed that? All right, a lot of retirement advertising. But the now generation has never really grown up, and those are our students, and they've established patterns. Affluence enables the postponement of adulthood. So the parents are not acting like adults, and the affluence that we have is allowing children to be children longer. We can tolerate a lot more because we can afford the expense. And we expect to peak early, in a sense. Stronger, faster, smarter, sexier. I shouldn't be, but I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm amazed at how much the otherwise very sensible people are in love with college athletes. I mean, they don't just like them. They just don't like, hey, that's a great guy. I mean, they pay money to sit next to him. I mean, he's 18. He can hardly read. And we just want to be his friend. Want him to hang out with us. These are adults. These are 60-year-olds acting like this. I'm not talking about kids admiring kids. I'm talking about grown people. It's amazing. So the first disadvantage is that our culture is in love with youthfulness. The second is teenagers are enigmatic. They are. Their brains are still developing, and that's true. That's true. And boys' brains develop more slowly than girls, or at least in different ways, which is obvious. Their moods are shifting, and they don't really know how they feel. They don't. Independence is forming, which is just a wicked combination for a moody person now to start really feeling like he can throw his weight around the house or the classroom. So teenagers are tough. Academic standards continue to sink. And by the way, let me go back to this real quickly about teenagers being enigmatic. A popular response to this in schools has been to concede all of this and to just play to it. Let's not do anything that's going to upset them. Let's not do anything that's going to stress them out. They've got enough stress in their lives already. Okay? Academic standards continue to sink. Last year, 50% of University of Texas freshmen needed remedial coursework. 70% of the students of the University of Texas graduated in the top 10% of their class in Texas, their high school class in Texas. And 50% of the total population needed remedial coursework. Top students are coming out of schools with automatic admission to one of the top public universities in the country. Can't read. Or do basic math. Or whatever it is that is going to undermine their success. So, how does this pose a disadvantage to us? The other high schools that are producing these students are easier. And our students know it. And these kids are still getting into, you know, what might be considered good colleges. Success is defined by the absence of consequences and is often absent results. That is to say, if you don't do something really bad, if you don't do something really stupid, I'm going to give you the grade just because you're not much trouble. And the kids know that. That showing up can get them the credential that they need. And nothing's changing. I know that there have been improvements programmatically here and there. System-wide, though, conventional schools in America, we keep doing the same things, expecting the same results, and the schools are not getting any better. They're not getting any better. Now, occasionally, we change the test to make it look like we're doing better. And that helps everybody's self-esteem. All the way from the legislature down to the kids in kindergarten. But we're not getting any better. But we're not changing the way that we do things either. the other disadvantage. Sorry, you can hardly see this. Has it been that way the whole time? Oh. This word's quality. Sorry about that. Quality schooling is hard work. It's hard work for us, it's hard work for them. It requires an intentional culture. It requires an intentional culture. It requires a partnership between teachers and learners. And this is one of the key sticking points with high school kids. How do you craft that partnership? They don't think we're cool. They'll tell us we're cool if they can get something from us, but they don't think we're cool. And it requires accountability. And none of us really like that. All right, so what's the goal? What's the goal? What does the school look like, this classical and Christian high school? Number one, it absorbs students into its intentional, mission-oriented culture. We'll talk about what that means in just a second. Secondly, it values students as they are without accepting adolescence as an ideal. And it motivated students to achieve more than they thought they could or wanted to, we might add, or wanted to. All right, so let's talk about steps. How do we move toward an intentional culture? Am I going too fast? Motivate students to achieve more than they thought they could. I'm going to try to fix this. Thank you very much. All right. Ready? Working towards a goal. Intentional culture. Number one, treat students as a concern with the respect they deserve and that they crave. Remember, we're starting from the premise of love answers love. Love answers love. What does this look like? What does this look like? Well, let me pop down here. It looks like, I'll give it to you in a negative. It looks like not denigrating the things that they're interested in because they are adolescents. That's a negative, okay? And I think this is a little harder for us in classical schools because we really think we're smart. And we really think we're sophisticated, and we are. I don't know if we are more than other teachers. We know a lot. We've got a lot going on, and we think a lot about what we do. And it matters to us. And it's easy to become impatient with the fact that, you know, kids want to talk about football, and girls want to, you know, read the Us magazine, and that's what they, you know, and they're on MySpace for, you know, 3 hours a night. Okay, you love that, don't you? All right, those are things that some things we're just not going to be able to do anything about. Okay? And if we spend a lot of time, or if we act dismissively toward all of those things because they are such a waste of time to us, then the students will not, are likely not going to feel like we respect them. If we need to increasingly treat students with we need to engage them in conversation about problems that we have with them. Okay? When they were in second grade, we could sit them in the corner, they'd sort it out, and you know, come back to everybody fits in. But if all we do with high school kids is try to control their behavior, then they, at some point, are going to, they're going to draw the conclusion that we don't really respect them as individuals, as people who have the capacity to examine their own motivations and to make decisions that are going to make their life easier. So the culture that we create, in a sense, needs to focus more on the students than it did when they were younger, and look for ways to assign respect to them in ways that matter to them, in ways that they feel. Secondly, give them real responsibility for their environment. Give them the opportunity to make decisions that affect the way that they live together at school, affect the way that school works. Give them responsibility that affects how money gets spent. Not just how they can raise some money for us. You ever notice that? We send the kids out to sell the candy. They never get to decide what to do with it. You know? Give them real responsibility. And this means, by the way, that you're going to have to live with their mistakes. And you got to go in knowing that they're going to mess things up. But if our response to them making mistakes is to take responsibility away from them and never trust them again because they prove that they're untrustworthy, then we're back up to number one and the whole respect issue. And we're also not looking at this as an educational opportunity. Different ways to give responsibility to students. You might have some yourself. An active student government that gets to make decisions for the student body, that gets to make recommendations to the faculty, to the administration, about things that matter to the students. We're only just kids. What do they know? They're just going to want us to give them pizza all the time. I mean, we kind of assume, before we ever even have conversations with kids, that they're not capable of having meaningful conversations about school. That their ideas really are going to be insignificant. When I do focus groups in schools, and I do a lot of these, where I'll interview all the different constituencies in a school, invariably, when I ask students, usually do 7th grade, 9th grade, and 11th grade, invariably, when I ask students about why they're at this school rather than someplace else, I get more substantive and answers that are more related to the mission of the school than their parents, and sometimes more than the faculty. So for all of the silliness and all of the, you know, stuff that's going on, all of the distractions, most kids know what's important. Most kids do. And you give them the opportunity to talk about it and to act on it, you get a lot of really cool things happening. Honor councils. How many of you have an honor council in your school that's student-led? Giving students responsibility for the both the moral instruction, the ethical instruction in the school, and the enforcement of honor codes. So now that the students are making decisions about their own conduct together, student government associations can be used usefully, or can be utilized this way too. We had a problem in one of my schools with a consistent, it was a vandalism thing. It kept happening. And obviously it was a big joke for somebody, but it was costing us money and it was, you know, disruptive and all of that. And we couldn't figure out how to stop it. It just kept happening. And we'd make our announcements and say, you know, you all better. So we asked the student government, the officers of student government, to come up with an appeal to the student body and see if they could have an effect. It never happened again after that. We weren't even in the room. We just, you know, student assembly, student government, look people, and they took that responsibility. Value and reward progress toward mature accomplishments. One of the difficulties that we run into in small high schools, especially those that have grown out of elementary programs, is that we sort of come late, or we remember late, that these kids are really starting to do important things and make important decisions. And we need to be aware of what's going on so that we can celebrate that. Some of the obvious things, of course, are academic awards and sports and that sort of thing. You know, we like when our students succeed, especially for the sake of the school. But, you know, kids are out there, they're getting their Eagle Scout stuff. You know, you got little girls getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to swim or to ice skate before school, going off and doing these, you know, having these big competitions. You've got kids who are working in their churches or working in soup kitchens, you know, just as a habit because somehow it has become important to them. Those things need to be celebrated and noted and direct, and so that the rest of the school, and not just amongst the high school students, the whole school, so the rest of the school begins to get the picture that our high school kids are different than all the rest of the kids. Our high school kids are growing up. They're becoming responsible individuals. Every time a student gets accepted to college, the whole school needs to know. The whole school needs to know, and that needs to be celebrated. At several schools that I know of, there's a morning assembly for the whole school. And if the school is arranged in a quad, or the students are arranged in sort of a square, over the course of their lives, they move around that room until finally they're the seniors and they're in the front, and they're getting all this attention every morning because every day there's something to celebrate about what's happening in the lives of our seniors as they go on. And it gives a picture. It gives a picture. Sam Cox can verify this statistic for you, but I think I got this from him. He worked at the St. John's School near Jacksonville, not far from here. And at one period in that school's life, not too long ago, I don't know if this statistic is still true, they had a 98% retention rate between kindergarten and 12th grade. Now that was probably not including people who moved or whatever else, but people who stayed in Jacksonville or that area, it's not right in Jacksonville, 98%. How do you do that? Well, it's not because your third grade is so great. It's because students are being absorbed up into the culture of that high school, and they all see it. They all want to be there. Partnership. Number one, be kind. Be kind. This is always a little bit of a struggle for me. And it's not because I don't like high school kids, but it's because, you know, I get carried away and I'll be more sarcastic than they can handle. And I'll wound somebody just through the banter. Some of us, you know, that's part of our nature, part of our personality. And we have to be really, really careful about that. We have to kind of let high school students be sarcastic toward us sometimes and just, you know, take it and not give it, right? But we need to be kind. Lots of other ways that we need to be kind to students. We need to be careful that in our discipline that we're not capricious or that we don't overreact to things. There's a tendency, especially in a young school, with that first group of high school students coming through, that when something happens, it's the first whatever, you know, the first drinking party, you know, or the first cheating scandal, or the first, and our instinct sometimes is to make an example out of them. Don't you know that all the people in this school look up to you? Don't you know how much we put into founding this school, and now you've ruined it for all of us? We need to be kind. We need to help them cope with responsibility, but look for ways to relieve unnecessary pressure. Our high schools are too busy. Too busy. This is not a rule, but I would challenge you. If you have more than six periods in your high school, I would challenge you to look at your program and decide and answer the question, why do we need more than six periods? We have a tendency to pile it on in high school. And yes, we need to help them to learn to build and to take more responsibility, but we've also got to look for ways to take the pressure off of them. That's what I found when I went into that hallway at Faith Christian School and I watched my four students scurrying around like animals, like little lab rats. You know? There's way too much pressure on these kids. Bad enough being 15. You know? Let's take the pressure off. Everything that we think for them to do is not necessary. Doesn't matter if it's good. Doesn't matter if it's good. It's not necessary. By the way, over the last couple of years, I've had the privilege of helping four schools, do either high school launches or redevelopment projects, renovations of the high school program. And in Texas, what some of the schools have fallen into is just matching up their credits, required credits for graduation, with the public schools. Partly because they don't want to be accused of, you know, being less rigorous than public schools. So they'll have 26, 28, whatever, 30, you know, credits the kids need to get, which is a burden already. I mean, think about all the classes that a kid has to take in 4 years. When is he ever going to think? You know? When is he ever going to eat? When is he ever going to write the profound papers that we need for them to write because we're a classical school? When are we going to have any time for conversation because every 42 minutes the bell rings and we got to run to the next thing? Well, we did some research and the top prep schools in Texas, as a rule, have 25 credits required for graduation or fewer. St. John's in Houston, which is probably the top prep school in Houston, requires 19 and a half credits to graduate. And they're pipelined to the Ivy Leagues. So we've convinced ourselves that all this busyness is really necessary because it proves that we're really, you know, we're really in there, we're really working them. It's not really true. We want to be partners with them. We need to learn with them about themselves. Learn with them about themselves. And that means in the high school environment, I would encourage you to provide more time for students and faculty to talk, more time for students and faculty to do things together so that the students are more known to the faculty. We have a better understanding of of what motivates them, so that we can share those insights with them and say, you know, I've noticed this about you, and, you know, here's a situation where you're really going to have to push through this, and I know that it's going to be hard for you, but I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there with you. And, you know, it'll be all right. Finally, accountability. We need to set goals in our high schools that will exceed their needs at the next stage of life. And that can mean a lot of things. But it means that when they leave us and they look back on their experience with us, that we want them to feel better prepared than they needed to be for all of the responsibilities that they face. It's not just that they, I mean, it is, it's nice to hear. I went to, you know, college and, you know, all my classes were so easy. Well, okay. I mean, I can hear that as a compliment, because I do want my students to be academically prepared. I can hear it as a backward, as sort of a backdoor indictment too. And maybe we worked them too hard. Maybe we could have backed off a little bit. And they didn't have to be so busy. They didn't have to manage their time quite so well. I want them prepared too. We want them prepared too, though, for the social opportunities and social obligations that they're going to have. We need to give kids practice with the things, the social norms, the social environments that they're going to encounter out there. I know that in some schools we have a tendency to not to want to imitate, you know, what the social things are in other schools for whatever reason. But you know what? If I want to have a special event, and the best thing I can do, the best thing I can figure out to distinguish it from what's happening in those other schools is to not call it the prom. That's the best I can do. Then I need to think more about what we're trying to get done. Or if the best I can do is just not have it because it's just such a bother, you know, then I need to think more about how serious I am about high school students. For the students, we need to maintain reasonable consequences for irresponsibility. Disciplining high school kids requires a lot of skill. Holding students accountable for behavior requires a lot of skill. And part of the skill is deciding at different points, because it changes, what your priorities are going to be. I'm working with the school right now that in the last year and a half has experienced almost complete breakdown of discipline in their high school. I mean, almost a complete breakdown. And so you can't just go in there with a new set of rules and say, this is how we're going to, you know, we have to approach it from the standpoint of, we're going to start with the things that are easy. You know, it's the Rudy Giuliani, you know, if you get rid of the panhandlers and, you know, and the prostitutes, then it kind of sends a message to everybody that, you know, the new sheriff's in town, we're going to do this. Right? But that's a special situation in that school, and that's what they need. They need to restore order. Okay? Most of our schools are not in that kind of trouble. We don't have to restore order, but we need to know what's important to us, and we need to know ahead of time what our basic, not what we're going to do, what our basic response is to the problems that we're going to have. The kids in your school are going to drink beer. Okay? Now, maybe not at school, but they might. Alright? But just get ready. Has it happened? Has it happened yet? That we know of? Yeah. Okay. Alright. So we have to have a philosophy of what that says to us about our students, and how important is that to us in the whole grand scheme of things. It might be very important. It might not be that important. But you need to know what it is. They're going to do lots of things. They're going to do crazy things. They're going to destroy property. They're going to vandalize or terrorize the neighbors of the school. They're going to do all sorts of things. And most of the time, it won't be malicious. Most of the time, it'll just be, you know, the brain turned off, and they didn't think about the consequences. We need to know what we're going to do. Another thing related to this is that we need to be ready to stand in defense of our high school kids when they mess up. And the fourth grade moms want to lynch them all because they're a bad example to their kids. You gotta be ready for that. And we need to assume responsibility for their success. This is academically, this is spiritually, this is socially. If we have students who are consistently failing in our schools, it's because we've got a bad school. If they were with us through 7th or 8th grade and they get into the high school and all of a sudden, you know, it just looks like the footing has gone completely out from under them, it's our fault. It's our fault. And we need to adopt this attitude of no failures, no excuses on behalf of our students for their sake. I don't want them to fail. Grade distribution, whatever. Nobody should be failing in my school. Doesn't mean that nobody will. Nobody should. And they're going to do things that require me to fail them on occasionally. But it better not be my fault. It better not be because I didn't put enough effort in. It better not be because I wasn't insightful enough to be able to help a student figure out the problem, or that I didn't have the energy to help him get where he needed to go and get beyond those expectations. No failures, no excuses. Do you have any questions or comments as we conclude? Thank you. Yeah, John. Yeah. The question is, what did I mean in a conversation I don't remember when I said you have to teach kids to love their school? I think, well, what I probably meant was that we have to give them things that they will love, that they want to love. And then you have to just keep guiding them into an investment in the life of their school.
Everybody in this room has been able to work from business, their neighbor.
Say it again. Their neighbor with what?
Everyone in this room with a neighbor with some aspect of liberal arts, not facilitating, whatever it is, they're turning their back. They're keeping.
Right.
We all have those. And, but our kids are in love with a whole other set of stuff. And
they don't care about any of the things we care about.
That's my point.
Yeah.
But they can be inspired to come around to that.
Well, and
but it's not innate. We didn't love it when we were 13.
No.
We learned.
When we were 30.
Exactly.
Well, and I think we need to give them things to love about the school. Again, it's back to that, you know, valuing them, valuing adolescence without idealizing it. Give them things about the school to love that they can care about, that we don't have to convince them. So whatever it is, it's the dance or it's the football team or the things that kind of feed their adolescent energy. and feed that desire to be part of something. You know, they're tribal creatures. And if we give them a good tribe to belong to, they will stick with us. And if we give them those things that they naturally love as part of their experience with us, they will love their school. And they will learn to love and appreciate more about their school as they're older and reflect back. And by the way, we need that because we need their investment in our school and future generations. That might sound crass to you, but if a school graduates students who don't care enough about it when they can to send a check back, then that school has failed. That school has failed because it has not given that student a valuable enough experience that they want to duplicate that for somebody else. Yeah. To create the love? Football. Football.
And I just want y'all to know that you can listen to
I'm not surprised that she concluded that. Yeah, I don't mean football, just football. I mean, you know, athletics are important in my mind, not just because of the teamwork and, you know, all the other sort of character building stuff. They're important because they give us opportunities to build community. And students get included. It's a place for them to belong. And one of the great things about private schools and athletics is that kids can play more sports. And kids who are really bad athletes can still play sports. They can still be part, they can be included in that. And that's a huge, huge advantage. Parents will pay for that. Parents will pay for that. Great. Thank you.